Good morning. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, and this is Aspen Public Radio's live broadcast from the Aspen Institute. In just a moment, we will be joining the panel discussion Clash of Values, College Campuses, Free Speech, Inclusion, and Safe Spaces from the Aspen Ideas Festival. The discussion looks at the intersection of inclusion and free speech on college campuses. Hear the discussion in just a moment. Support for this live broadcast of the Ideas Festival comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com. You'll be able to listen to this discussion in full later today on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Good morning. In 1987, Ernest Boyer was commissioned by the Carnegie Foundation for the Teaching of Excellence to do a study on the American University campus. He wrote a really great book that became the handbook of how you think about college in America, and it was called America, the Undergraduate Experience. And it informed every university's president's understanding of the challenges and opportunities of a liberal arts institution. Well, the college has changed quite a bit since 1987. There are new opportunities and new challenges, the clash of values, free speech. There's no better panel that we've assembled than the team of exceptional higher education instructors and leaders who can inform our own understanding of what's going on the American University campus today. And it'll be led by the moderator, Dan Porterfield, the new president of the Aspen Institute.
Well, hey.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Eric. Come on up. We have an all-star panel for an extremely important discussion. So my name is Dan Porterfield. Prior to serving as the CEO and president of the Aspen Institute, I was president of Franklin and Marshall College for the past 7 years, and before that, senior vice president at Georgetown University. And today's topic is a big one, the clash of values, college campuses, free speech, and safe spaces. And here's how we're describing the panel. What is a university if not a true marketplace of ideas? A place where scholarly pursuits in history, science, literature, philosophy, art, and mathematics can be nurtured and questioned, where cross currents of diverse thought and perspectives can coexist. Today, students are challenged by the notion of an open society, tested on the one hand by the values of free expression, and on the other, by a profound belief in inclusion. Most, if forced to choose, might opt for the latter. But most also draw the line at hate speech, disavowing its right to First Amendment protections. How are universities responding, and how should they? To join us in this discussion, we have three extraordinary leaders in American higher education. And our conversation will go on for about 50 minutes. We'll try to break for questions at about the 30-minute point. I'm delighted to have with us today Christina Paxton, the president of Brown University, professor of economics and public policy, Robert Zimmer, the president of the University of Chicago, also a professor of mathematics, who previously served as chair of the math department and deputy provost, vice president for research, and David Cohen, who is the senior executive vice president and chief diversity officer for Comcast, and also a long-serving chair of the board at the University of Pennsylvania. And so we have some great leaders and important topics, and I thought I would organize our conversation around three sort of big themes: enduring commitments, first; secondly, today's challenges; and third, future considerations. And so first, these enduring commitments. Each of you is a leader committed to promoting and protecting, both keywords, free expression. And maybe could I ask, start with Bob, since you're closest to me. Why is it important? This may seem kind of basic, but why is it important that we promote and protect free expression?
Well, from the point of view of a university, it's essential to fulfilling our missions. Our mission is to, on one hand, educate students in the most challenging way we can so that they are empowered by a set of intellectual skills and habits of mind that will serve them for their entire life, and that they are simply not going to get the level of education and the level of preparation and developing these skills if they are not challenged in an ongoing way. And challenge means hearing things that are different. It means hearing different perspectives. It means hearing things that you are uncomfortable with. And simply without this, your education is going to be weaker. And the more you move away from this, the more mediocre your education becomes. Very simple. And it's the same thing with the research environment.
Yeah. So, and I'll turn to Chris for a second on the research. But one big reason to promote freedom of expression is for the formation of young adults to be able to develop their intellectual power. How about from the knowledge creation perspective?
Right, which is, and I agree with everything that Bob said. You know, one really important component of the mission of a research university is the creation of new knowledge, generating new ideas. And the way that happens, you know, the scientific process, is that people have to challenge the status quo. They have to challenge existing ideas if they're going to create new ones and make progress in lots of different areas. And this goes from scientific progress to work in the humanities and the social sciences. So that's another just foundational component of freedom of expression. Yeah.
So in other words, really no one creates a new idea or a new concept, a new paradigm for thought, by simply saying, well, the other ones were right. Right? We have to be on the edge of pushing forward.
You have to keep probing and testing and pushing. Yeah.
It takes courage, takes patience, and takes drive. David, is there any other consideration about the freedom of expression, the freedom of speech, besides the academic enterprise of forming students and developing new knowledge that speaks to you?
I think those are the two critical frames. I mean, you could list another 10 things, but I think they all fit underneath those two frames. As I listen to Bob, listen to Chris, I mean, I'm struck, and I have felt this in my role at Penn. And I think it's worth saying, just to be clear about it, which is a university is not a corporation. And the just listening, I mean, a corporation, I mean, we take our values very seriously, take our culture and our environment very seriously, but I don't think anyone would define the central mission of any for-profit corporation in America as academic freedom and the freedom of expression that undergirds academic freedom and the creation of an environment where every possible attitude, theory, and approach would be encouraged and respected. Yeah. So I'm the only person on this panel, including the moderator, with no academic title and no academic teaching experience. So I bring the trustee experience here, and so many trustees come more out of the business world than out of the academic world. And I think understanding that distinction is important to being a good trustee at an academic institution like a Brown or the University of Chicago.
Let me ask you a quick follow-up, and you'll notice they actually don't know what I'm going to ask them, so thank you for bearing with me. But David, there's also, of course, the fact that the First Amendment protects the freedom of speech, including unpopular and offensive speech even. And can I ask you just for a second, if another reason to promote and protect free expression is the constitutional principle, there is a little bit of a difference between a private and a public institution. And would you be comfortable just succinctly just describing that difference for our
audience? So I will do that, but I haven't thought this through all the way, and I'm also a lawyer. But I'm not even sure the First Amendment is the applicable principle for freedom of expression on a university campus. I don't know that, let's take Brown as an easy, I don't know the First Amendment really applies to Brown.
And that's
because
why
they're not a governmental entity.
But a public, the reason I'm asking the question.
That's why I went to Brown.
Yeah. Right.
So I sort of did that as the.
Or Chicago.
I think there are some core values in First Amendment jurisprudence and in what First Amendment means to people who are not lawyers and technically trained that can help to inform the importance of what I would call the broader term, which is freedom of expression. And I think that's the linkage, if you will, between the First Amendment and freedom of expression undergirding academic freedom, which is really, if it's not the central value of any quality college or university, in the United States, I actually couldn't name another value.
Yeah.
Could I add something there, which is, you know, I think the distinction between public and private is really important. And I, you know, I believe in the First Amendment myself personally, but that is not what drives what private universities are doing. We have a choice. Yeah. We don't have to have freedom of expression if we don't want to.
Yeah.
And in a way, it makes it easier for us because we can do what we want. But on the other hand, it makes it harder in that we're really having to think hard about what freededom of expression means on our campuses and what are the values that generate it.
And the reason I could just add
something along the same lines. So if there were no First Amendment, I would argue that what we've been saying still implies that universities need to be places of maximal free expression simply because we have a function. We're not a club, we're not a nation. We're an institution that has very clear goals and priorities as to what it is we're trying to accomplish, and active engagement and discourse is absolutely essential to that. So it's easier to do, honestly, in a country where there's this backdrop of the First Amendment as a kind of cultural touchstone. But if there were no First Amendment, I'd have exactly the same point of view as to what we need to do.
So I want to ask each of you, if you'd like, to reflect upon a moment in your lives when this, the value of promoting maximal free expression and protecting expression came home to you. Maybe you were 15, maybe you were 19, maybe you were 24. For me, the big moment was at Georgetown University as an undergraduate when Father Timothy Healy, legendary president of Georgetown, went to San Salvador and gave an honorary degree to Archbishop Oscar Romero, who was an advocate for the poor and was in an incredibly volatile situation with government and death squad activity happening all around it. Archbishop Romero could not leave San Salvador because he'd never get back into the country. So Tim went down and handed him an honorary degree from Georgetown University. 2 years later, Archbishop Romero was shot saying Mass. A year and a half later, the individual who was most likely to have been the one that ordered the assassination, Roberto Del Buisson, was invited by students to Georgetown University. I was working with recently arrived immigrants from El Salvador who had walked up from El Salvador to get away from the death squads. And I went into Father Tim Healy, who was my mentor, and said, "You can't let Del Buisson speak. You gave Archbishop Romero an honorary degree." Father Healy said, "Not my call who the students invite. I will protect their right to invite who they want. There are conditions, has to be safe, but I will protect it, even though I believe with you that Del Buisson did this horrible crime." And I pushed him, and he said, "Dan, you need to go to law school." So, over the years, as I wrestled with the example of my mentor, I came to appreciate the wisdom of his approach. In part was that if there's somebody deciding who can speak and who can't speak, that means everybody was approved. And nobody approved Roberto Del Buisson except for the students that invited. Well, was there a time in your lives comparable when this really became personal for you?
Well, when it was really personal was sitting around the dining room table when I was growing up and having an environment where it was okay to argue about everything. But I'll move beyond the childhood moment. So when I was in college, it was a time when there was both the civil rights movement and then kind of segueing into the protest around the Vietnam War. So these were two huge issues for the country, which became somewhat merged, but were mostly distinct. And it was a very clear example of places on campus where there were very, very serious disagreements about this. And I have my points of view about them, but I just thought that the value of having to argue this out was extremely valuable to me personally, because there really were differences of views about this, and people would push you, and you're opposed to the Vietnam War. Well, why is that? What about this? What about that? What's your answer? How do you think about these things? It was a hugely educational experience for me personally, and highlighted the importance of having to make an argument and seeing that arguments are not so simple to make.
Yeah, thank you. Chris, anything?
Oh, I don't have a story to top your story, right? I mean, I know you selected that question so you could tell your story.
Well, a little bit.
I'm just kidding.
A little bit. I wanted to praise Father Healy.
But you know, I will tell a somewhat childhood story, a teenage story, and I think it may come back to something that we'll talk about later, which is how do you help people feel comfortable expressing minority viewpoints?
Exactly. I'm coming.
Which is, you know, I grew up in a Quaker family and going to Quaker meeting, and everybody was a pacifist, and it was during the Vietnam War. And I decided at some point that I was not a pacifist. And the ability to kind of talk to the people who were good friends and I'd known my whole life and say, you know, I'm rejecting a central tenet of this religion.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
And so when I have students who come to my office, you know, with those sorts of concerns, I think I understand where they're coming from.
And I think you're saying that the Quaker tradition provided a forum and a setting where you could express views
opposition.
Counter to the tradition itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that was sort of an irony, which is I got a lot of acceptance for not believing what everybody else believed. That was great.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. So, David?
So I don't know if this is a commentary on my life, but I've got hundreds of these stories.
Yeah.
And a lot of them affect, a lot of them involve me. So maybe I'm like the ultimate contrarian. But I'm going to tell one you and I talked about, which is, I think, directly on point in the university experience. It involved a newly formed student group at Penn, the Penn BDS group. For those of you who don't know the BDS movement, it is a virulently anti-Israel and I believe anti-Semitic organization. BDS stands for Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions, and they advocate aggressively wherever they can for the boycott of companies that do business in Israel, the divestiture of stocks from endowments, pension funds, et cetera, of companies that do business in Israel, and for sanctions against Israel. So the student group decided to sponsor and invited the national BDS organization to the Penn campus for a national conference. I'm Jewish, Amy Gutman is Jewish, and I think the immediate uproar from every national Jewish organization in the country, every local Jewish organization in the country, every Jewish faculty member, many Jewish students. The assumption was, president of the university is Jewish, chairman of the board is Jewish, they're going to ban them. They're not going to let BDS show up on campus. So fortunately for me, Amy had exactly the same initial reaction that I did, which is exact opposite.
Right.
That's not what we do. It's really your story.
Yeah.
The students, I mean, this is not BDS coming to the university and saying, we want to put on a conference at Penn. This was a sanctioned student group that had invited a national BDS organization to come to campus, and no matter how abhorrent that speech was, we were going to honor that student organization's right and ability to invite people to come to campus to speak in a way that was offensive to us personally, and that was offensive to so many constituencies. And I'm actually proud of both of us. I'm proud of the university. I mean, we sort of came up with the right plan, which is you fight hateful speech with better speech.
Yeah.
And we worked with Hillel and the local Jewish organizations, the national Jewish organizations, and we counter-programmed the whole weekend. And a lot of morals to this story. I'll tell one story moral, and I'll tell one overall moral. So this all started with the Friday night major kickoff, Leonard in the Annenberg Theater, which we filled. Alan Dershowitz was the guest speaker. He said some of this publicly, some of it privately, but one of his major messages was, Alan Dershowitz, also Jewish, one of his major messages was, I am so thankful that Penn has taken this position, because if Penn had not taken this position, I would have to be showing up on campus defending and speaking in favor of BDS. And you've put me in a position where I can come to campus and condemn BDS, not their right to speak, but I can condemn their speech. And I have the freedom on this campus to express that opinion too. And then the overall macro finding from this weekend is the BDS conference attracted about 25 people, and there were several thousand people who attended the alternative programming. And that's the best way to fight speech that is abhorrent.
Let me take this.
Can I comment on this?
Yes, but I'm about to push us. I need some time for the next wave of questions. So
I'll be brief.
Yeah.
David didn't mention this, but I think this is an exceedingly important example for which there are multiple lessons. And the natural instinct of so many people who are Jewish would be to shut this down. And this phenomenon, having nothing to do with being Jewish, but simply the natural instinct to want to shut down people who you find offensive, wrong-headed, immoral, is huge. And almost everybody has it. And this is a key part of what is going on campuses now. So we're sitting here in a kind of natural, we're all in a good spot, we're all agreeing, we're all saying the same thing, which I think is good. But the under story of all of this is on campuses, but not just on campuses, is that people are very uncomfortable with a lot of speech and they want to shut it down. And that's why it's so important that universities be active and not passive in terms of protecting freedom of expression.
I just want to do one line, and then I promise only one line, which is, it's easy to be for open expression when you agree with the expression.
Yeah.
It's the challenge is when you hate the expression, and that's what puts all of us to the test when we have to deal with that.
Yeah. So the theme here is enduring commitments. So we also have an enduring commitment to providing a learning environment in which people of all backgrounds can come and engage and take the risk of growth. You agree with that, right? Everybody should take the risk of growth. So what happens when you're there as an 18, 19-year-old, ready to take the risk of growth, perhaps underrepresented, perhaps coming from a background where you haven't yet been in this kind of a setting with people of all these different income levels and all these different backgrounds. You have your own identity. You've asserted to get there. And, you know, maybe let's say you're gay or lesbian, and speakers start to show up who are invited who seem to be expressing a kind of a mentality, if extended, that, well, gay and lesbian people don't really have a place here. You're not 50 years old or 40 years old, you're 18, you're 19. I know you've all taken steps to provide an environment where those students who may be underrepresented can trust in the institution enough to take the risk of growth. Now, you didn't bring those speakers, but there they are. So how do you deal with that, with helping the 18, 19, 20-year-old who, you know, be able to feel, this is a place where I can take the risk of growth?
So let me start with that. I mean, and this is something I think over the past 5 years, 6 years, I've learned a lot about, right? And it wasn't something I expected to be in the middle of when I became a university president. And, you know, what I've realized is that it's all about education, and it has to start even before they come to campus, to let students know that they're valued, they're welcomed, to talk very explicitly about university values. So say, freedom of expression is just essential, and this is why. You have to teach people that. And also make it clear that we welcome a wide variety of people, and we're going to support students no matter what. So it's talking about those values, talking about the supports that are available so that they know what they're getting into.
So there's a lot of students who are immigrants who are make it to top colleges like yours, like mine. And there's a lot of conversation about immigration today. Mm-hmm. Is it the place of a college or university to try to bring to campus speakers that can speak to the experience of immigration and say to students, you know, I'm here, I get you. Intellectually, here's some thoughts about the patterns of immigration, about the economic benefits of immigration. Is that a good thing to proactively hope that try to encourage speakers that will allow students to connect?
Well, I think that happens naturally. I mean, the university as a is not a monolith inviting speakers, right? I don't sit in my office and choose speakers. Mm-hmm. We have institutes, centers, departments, student organizations, and I think their tendency is to bring in speakers who will speak to issues that students are concerned about. We have a first-gen low-income center. A lot of immigrant students are part of that. They have support systems. They have people who they bring in to speak.
Yeah.
So
there's a role for the
there's
college.
There's absolutely a role for the university to do that.
Yeah.
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 I'm done. I'm done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I completely agree with everything Chris has said. I just add a couple of things. So first, everybody needs help being in an environment of free expression. This is not just minorities, not just underrepresented groups. Again, because it is not a natural state. People grow up in certain environments and certain cultures. Most of them have been told and arrive with a sense of this is what's good, and if things don't fall inside the paradigm that I've lived with and been told what was good and supported that, they're going to see certain people as not good and evil and wonder what on earth are they doing on my campus. So I think it's everybody who needs that. I certainly think that it is true that there are, as you both pointed out, particular issues around traditionally minority groups or traditionally excluded groups where it gets highlighted. But one shouldn't say, well, this is a problem for dealing with minorities or excluded. It's a problem for dealing with everybody. Yep. And in this regard, there's a really interesting question, which is how well are high schools doing in preparing students for the type of college experience that we're talking about? And I've actually been meeting with groups of high school heads and asking them that question, which is you prepare students to take calculus or advanced calculus. In high school, you prepare students to write history papers. Do you prepare students for an environment of open discourse and intellectual challenge? I'll leave you to your own opinion as to how well they're doing, but I would say as a whole, this is an area that needs a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's not pretending that high schools are Brown University or the University of Chicago or the University of Pennsylvania, but high schools are preparing students or should be preparing students to go into this environment.
Yeah.
So it's why everybody needs help with these issues.
So there's two narratives attached to our institutions. One is that because of the need to cultivate academic excellence and intellectual discovery, we allow and promote, encourage, and protect the widest range of expression. The other hand, there's also with that, maybe not the other hand, complementary in narrative, that we seek to be a place that allows the young to come, to thrive, to feel seen and heard, and to connect. And that sense of whole person being developed is also a part of what we're doing, certainly at the undergraduate level. Now, I don't understand why these two traditions of American higher education are seemingly in conflict.
They're not.
They shouldn't be. They shouldn't be.
Although, you know, the poll results that you quoted put them in conflict, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, that was a poll where the question was, do you believe in freedom of expression? Most students said yes.
Yeah.
Do you believe in diversity and inclusion? Most students say, why were they asked to choose one or the other?
Yeah, well, I didn't make the poll, but I can tell you, you're living the conflicts because they appear on your campuses pretty regularly in mine.
Yeah.
So why are these two traditions of American higher education seemingly in conflict? Maybe they really aren't.
Because people don't actually believe in freedom of expression. They're wrong when they say that. They believe in their own freedom of expression, freedom of expression for people they're sympathetic to. They don't believe in freedom.
They want to, make sure they have the right to express their views.
We definitely have a moment of presidential candor, which is difficult in our field.
I say, don't believe drawing on part of my past background, don't believe every poll you see. There are a lot of crummy polls out there, and Bob and I were talking about this beforehand. That poll can't be accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, by the way, I think it's probably understated in the statements for the reasons that Bob said.
Yeah.
I just want to add one thing here before you move on. Totally agree with what Chris and Bob said, but I want to, going to your original question, I don't think it's, when we say, should the university bring speakers on and create programs, I think that's probably too broad a statement. I think there are, and Chris touched on this, there's so many touch points within colleges and universities for this kind of a dialogue. So, and particularly around known times of crisis or potential unrest or unhappiness by students. So Penn has a growing and developing college house system, and we do a lot of communication, proactive and reactive within the college house, where a faculty member actually brings together the residents of the house, and you have these kinds of discussions. Not something that Bob can do, but our athletic programs are fantastic places where we've been able to have calming dialogues. Right now we have an incredibly forward-thinking athletic director, graduate of Brown, I think, yeah, if I remember correctly. And she, around the Trump election, which created a lot of tension on the campus, a campus was probably among the students was, 90-10 against Donald Trump, but I mean, there was some real tension on the campus around that, and she brought all the teams together, used all the coaches, and just sort of had dialogue and discussion. And so all I'm saying is there are ways, other than calling a speaker, you can use embedded clubs, organizations, groups, yeah, segments within, yeah, the university environment to create a dialogue that can help to diffuse some of the discomfort that you identified in your, yeah, question.
And just to add on that, I don't want to leave people with the impression that presidents don't do anything. We just let stuff all grow around us. And, just an example, over the past several years, I've co-hosted with the provost a speaker series called Reaffirming University Values. And it brings in people from a wide range of backgrounds. And it's really meant to model to students how we do this, yeah, because they don't really know. At the beginning of this year, we did a big faculty panel talking about what happened in Charlottesville. Yep. And it was packed. I mean, it was sort of a potentially explosive moment.
Yeah.
And so having that sort of intervention at that point in time was really important.
Had you not done that, you would have heard from your community that it was a major topic of concern to many. We need an affirmative action to bring that topic into the public space of the campus for intellectual discussion and reflection.
And it was the first week of classes.
Yeah.
So
I remember
it was a
well.
Really important point. Yeah.
An interesting feature of this also is the way the word discomfort is used. So there's a lot of discussions which essentially problematize discomfort, as if there's something wrong with being uncomfortable. And I think that itself is a problem. It sort of lumps under one word a whole variety of phenomenon, and discomfort itself is not a problem. In fact, it's a natural consequence of a challenging intellectual environment. And so when one hears people saying, well, what happens if students are uncomfortable? It depends what you're talking about. If you're in a situation where you've got some virulently racist or anti-Semitic people living next door to them in their residence hall, yeah, that's a problem. If they're uncomfortable because they're hearing views that they find actually offensive or wrongheaded, but that the necessity for them to argue about that and see through it and learn how to challenge it, or even more importantly, actually challenge their own assumptions, then discomfort's a good thing.
Yeah.
So the automatic problematizing of discomfort is a problem.
I think these tensions that can be created through the protection of free expression, and I'll go back to my BDS example, and we saw this, and I got some wonderful notes from students, and they actually use this expression. This is the best learning experience I've had since coming to Penn. And I think that's what I hate to say this, that's what the college and university setting is supposed to do. It's why we want to protect freedom of expression, because it is part of the educational experience, the learning experience, and making better young adults than when they arrived on our campus.
So one more question, then I'm going to open it up. And the question is, and let's not go for the long answer, but the sort of crisp one on this, is there a crisis? Is there a crisis? Everyone in that audience has read articles about outrageous circumstances, seemingly outrageous, on certain campuses where a speaker is sort of heckled down or where there's a giant protest that seems like it's not under control, that intimidates an event from going on, or that hears about a speaker who opts out. This is different, I think, but who opts out because they don't want to deal with unrest they expect coming. We've all read these articles. They seem to define the Academy today. You both, and the three of you, all say you're committed to both narratives. So do we have a crisis, a real crisis happening on the campuses where we work, or do we have a crisis in the public space on how we're being defined?
Well, I don't like the word crisis because it creates the sense that doom is upon you the next minute if you don't fix up something in the next 24 hours. Yeah. So just to get away from the hysterical, my own view is that there is, in fact, a deeply serious problem, that it's pervasive, that the kind of spectacular things you see are symptoms, but they themselves are not the real problem, and that the real problem is what is happening day to day. If you are on most college campuses and you are living in a residence hall and you have politically conservative viewpoints, which are generally speaking antithetical to those in the environment, what's the nature of the discourse going on? Are you ostracized? Are people, how is that discourse going? Mm. How are faculty responding to students who are passionate, self-righteous, declaring they know what's good and bad? Nobody likes being declared an evil person and a bad person and shouted at in public being said you're a bad person. How much of that is influencing people's behavior? So I think the symptoms you're seeing of these kind of big, spectacular things about which I have some other views, but it is not really the main point. The main point is how do we reinsert into campuses across the country this sense of mutual intellectual challenge, mutual intellectual tolerance, which doesn't, intellectual tolerance doesn't mean you're polite and forgiving. Yep. It means you take what the person says seriously and deal with it.
A set of problems, but let's not call it a crisis. Chris?
So I would maybe, this may be one area where we disagree a little bit.
Yeah.
Right? So we should have a little disagreement.
Yeah.
And you know, I take a longer view, I think, which is, you know, universities always get contentious, difficult, during times when there's a lot of social change and a lot of polarization in society as a whole. And we saw this during the Vietnam War era. We saw it during McCarthyism. We saw it during the discussions about abolition in the 1800s. Yeah. And you know, so these things are, they're broad, they're in society, they play out on campuses. And so we have episodes where we face these issues and we grapple with them and we address them and then we go back into a period of calm again.
Yeah. So a recurring phenomena.
Recurring phenomena, not a crisis. Yep. But when it happens, that's the point where you really need to address it.
Bingo.
Right.
David's a board member. You have a different role than a president,
right,
obviously, on these questions. But from your vantage point, and then I'm going to open it to the audience, how do you frame the moment that we're in today?
So I actually don't know, Chris, that you disagreed that much with Bob.
Well,
I'm not going to disagree that much either.
I was just trying to inject.
I think this is one, the conflicts that arise out of freedom of expression is one of many challenges that all of us, the college and university community, have to our culture and to our commitment to education and to protecting and nurturing our students while challenging them and making sure that they graduate in a better position. So I think it's something that requires ongoing proactive as well as reactive attention. But in my judgment, it doesn't arise anywhere near to what I would call a crisis in American higher education.
Okay, good.
And there is an outrage machine out there that I think that's taking isolated incidents and overinflating them.
Yeah, so there's that point. Yeah. Okay, we're going to, lots of hands. May I ask that you ask your question in the form of a question? Because the more questions we get, the more short answers we get, the more dialogue we're going to have. So right there with the glasses, you, yes.
Hi, everybody. To make it quick, I guess we're hearing a lot about what we can do for students. I'm wondering, what are you thinking about doing for faculty members and professors to get in line with these same ideas that we're talking about today? Like, how are we empowering professors to follow along with what you've been talking about?
Well, I mean, my own view about this is that faculty play an absolutely critical, pivotal role. I mean, they are on the ground and inevitably are the ones who have to model discourse, have to create discourse, and so on. The best thing we can do for faculty is be very clear that they are protected in being a place, in being an individual who's going to be stimulating, challenging discourse. And, you know, we have plenty of faculty members who at various points in their careers take very controversial positions, and I and they get a lot of mail about what they've done. And, you know, we have no, it's never an issue. I mean, we just tell them we're going to, they don't need to worry about it, and we'll take care of all the letters we have. So the minute you start kind of waffling on this, and you yourself as a leader become afraid of confronting self-righteous mobs, let me say, then you're delivering a message to everybody in the organization that you have to be afraid of confronting self-righteous mobs.
One of the things I've been pleased with at Franklin and Marshall is that our faculty developed a statement of freedom of expression, which included some nuance around when is something harassment and not simply freedom of expression. But on the other hand, they also developed a whole approach to inclusive pedagogy so that they could be effective educators in a classroom that's changing rapidly in terms of the demographic backgrounds of our students. And they felt they could accommodate both of those commitments. Let me look on this side.
Can I add one more thing to that?
Please.
You know, one thing that we're all having to deal with a lot more is faculty who feel like they're being attacked in social media. And this is on the left, it's on the right, and their writings are no longer sort of within the academy. They're out there. And so just having to take, you know, telling the faculty that we have their backs when it comes to their expression.
That's a critically key important addition. Yes, indeed. Yeah. Key addition. So over here, I think, right.
Hi, my name is John Donvan. I happen to be the parent of a Chicago senior at present, and I also happened last Saturday to have moderated a debate about the issue of safe spaces. Yeah. And I'm turning this into a question now. The notion of the outrage machine came up in the debate, and my own research on it showed me surprisingly that the number of incidents that we're talking about are ridiculously small, that the number of schools in a recent given year out of 4,700 colleges tracked where students tried to shout down or disinvite a person was less than 1%, 35, suggesting to me that perhaps this problem is overly exaggerated. And my question comes to President Zimmer. When the University of Chicago 2 years ago, your Dean Ellison published a letter saying, we're not a safe space kind of place, and my son confirmed for me, Chicago is not a safe place kind of space. Was this a marketing move more than anything else, since there is this outrage machine?
Yeah, so I would say that anybody who says this is a marketing move is being pretty offensive, to be honest. This is not a marketing move. This is a statement of a principle about what the University of Chicago has stood for in terms of being what we think of as the most challenging intellectual environment. And so the simple answer to your question is no, it was not. It was meant to reflect the values of the University of Chicago and what we stand for.
And you thought it was important to get it to first-year students before they showed up, partly because of the dynamics of high school where the table hasn't been set
enough? It was in an environment in which this is an ongoing issue where you can say, well, how can you be opposed to safe spaces? You're opposed to people being safe. Well, of course, what happens is the word safe spaces becomes a place where you can now say, well, these views are really abhorrent to me. I need a place where I feel safe. Well, we're not opposed to the right to free assembly, but the idea that you're going to create these environments where people do not have to confront serious intellectual things because they feel uneasy is just, it's just all wrong. And again, I want to point out that these things are real, and it's not just the super popular thing of shouting things down. There is a real environment of what I would say is a orthodoxy of views as to what's acceptable thought. There always, going back to Chris's point, there always is such a thing, and it always needs to be confronted inside a university environment. We happen to have one right now where there's a particular moral stance to it, but there's always been a moral stance to it. I mean, all of the examples Chris pointed out, it's not as if people were not saying they have the moral right and so on. Everybody always thinks they're morally right. People who are opposed to other people's free expression don't say, well, they're good, but I don't want to hear them. They say they're jerks. So it's really a matter of how you're dealing and how you're talking and how you're talking about an environment which is ongoing and pervasive. And it goes back to what I was saying before. People don't want challenge. They don't want free expression. And, the University of Chicago has been devoted to this environment since its beginning. And that's who we are.
We're in the lightning round, the last 5 minutes, so ask your questions succinctly right there with your, that's it. I'm sorry, actually I called on the woman to your left, to your right.
Thank you so much. So I'm here as an Aspen scholar, but also as a Leda scholar, so it's great to be here. Yeah. So the question that I had was essentially, if we know that currently universities are dealing with free speech and trying to obviously like have this be present while also boasting about their diversity statistics and also trying to increase the retention rate of these students from marginalized backgrounds, when the freedom, when we are protecting free speech that reinforces that these students shouldn't be on these college campuses, how are you also dealing with and addressing your goals of increasing the retention rate of students like me on campus and making it a space for us to exist as well? So just real quick, an example of this is Stanford. I just graduated from Stanford.
Is it okay if I actually pause on the example and get to the moderators? Because you asked the question very well. I'd like to hear what they have to say.
Absolutely.
So just to get back, I think, you know, the challenge of making sure that every student who comes to Brown feels welcome at Brown, feels like they deserve to be there. It's something that I say the first day they come to them every year. You know, you are all here because you deserve to be here. You have to follow that up with action. That means having support services for our veterans, for example, who often feel like they're under attack, their ideas, their views, and even their experiences are being threatened. We have a first-gen low-income center. So we do have different centers and programs that are really there to support different types of students, and many students cross boundaries across those centers and programs, and they're meant to be supportive. So I think we need to do that for all students, in addition to supporting freedom of expression. I don't see those as being at odds with each other at all.
Next question, right there and straight ahead. Yes, you in the yellow pants. Yes. Do you have yellow pants on too?
I guess so. I guess I wore the right outfit. At any rate, are we not missing an opportunity in looking at that 6 months when a student gets accepted to college and sort of floats from January to June, last half of their senior year, in what I call the handoff from the high school to the university? Can the universities and high schools do a better job at partnering and getting students ready for some of these issues?
Good question. Anybody have an answer to that?
I'd say yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we have an online course for students that they do in the summer before they come to Brown that addresses these issues. Yeah.
Bob, anything you want to add to that?
No, I think, it is a really good question. I mean, we also have been working on this, but I would not say we've achieved the maximum that can be done in this way.
I'm going to look toward the back of the room, if I can, all the way back, straight ahead, you with your hand up right there. Yes.
Hi, Hi, Barry Weiss from the New York Times. I had an experience here last night where two people, very prominent in their fields, told me that they would never associate with a social conservative and that people that are socially conservative are horrible and maybe even evil. I'd like for you to reflect on the extent to which you think the politics of campus are sort of bleeding out into the broader culture.
Okay. It's a question of, I think, theory. I'm not sure if there's data behind it, but go.
Well, I'll give you my answer to that. I mean, I'm not sure it isn't the other way around.
Yeah.
That is that the politics and divisiveness of the times is not bleeding into our colleges and universities. A number of people in this room have heard me say this before. I mean, I think this is one of the great challenges we face as a society today, generally in the society. Be a little provocative and say, maybe even at the Aspen Ideas Festival, and certainly on our college and university campuses. Yeah. So,
yeah. Yes, you were patient last time. Thank you.
Hi, Peter Zahn from San Diego. I want to touch more on the safe space and discomfort issue, and Dan particularly brought it up. I think students do arrive at your institutions with some issues that definitely should be dealt with, and they're being coddled. But isn't there something of a race to the bottom among colleges and universities to protect and coddle these students, whether it's from parental pressures or whatever, and you're making it more cushy and more protective? Yep. And so are there ways that I notice also that all of you are with private universities, and my sense is that maybe public universities will have a little bit less of that, but not always.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to take your question.
Is there a way you can resist?
So are we nurturing
can you resist
butterflies?
Those pressures?
Are we making students more like snowflakes?
I don't think our students are coddled. I would strongly disagree with that. I just don't think they are. And in fact, a lot of the students who are coming in to get back to the earlier question have come from really tough life experiences. They are not coddled people. And they're people who care a lot about what's going on in the world. They want to address concerns in the world. And I'm incredibly proud of them. Yep. We're not trying to pamper them.
Many thanks to David, Chris, and Bob for your thoughts today, your work, your leadership. Thank you all for being here.
This is Aspen Public Radio, and you've been listening to a live broadcast titled Clash of Values, College Campuses, Free Speech, Inclusion, and Safe Spaces from the Aspen Ideas Festival of the Aspen Institute. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. You can also find this discussion in full later today on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Support for this live broadcast of the Ideas Festival comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com.